So again, welcome everyone to this day of mindfulness. This is the Dharma talk, question and answers. Then when the talk is done, we will have a mindful lunch and a little rest break. So mindful lunch is not something you eat. Mindful lunch is about how we go about eating. And in the same way we are learning to sit and walk and stand in awareness, presence, we also, since we do eat, we want to learn that we can eat very present to the experience of eating, taste and texture and color, body, you know, the whole experience of eating. Aware of the people eating around us, so it's could be a communal, we're present to our surroundings, we're not walled off. And as well, it's an opportunity to reflect that the food we are eating comes to us from many causes and conditions. Not only the causes and conditions of the place where we bought the food, whoever prepared the food, stocked the food, shipped the food, harvested the food, grew the food, all the way back to the seeds, all the way back to the earth that sustained the food and nurtured the food so it could grow, and the water, and the sky and the clouds, and the sky and the clouds and the earth could not exist without all the other forces in the universe. So all this is going on when you eat, as well as you are the expression of the universe too. And you have all the elements in you. So there's more going on when we eat than we may be aware of. So it's a good time to reflect. Then at 1:30, there'll be mindful movements, followed by a guided meditation, followed by a break, followed by a short silent meditation, and then guide you in more meditation and a final dialogue, and we will have our closing circle and end by 4. So before I begin the teachings that I've chosen for today, are there any questions? So in terms of the practices we've done today, mindfulness, meditation, sitting, walking, mind and thoughts, anything in terms of the instructions that you've received, the practices you've done, anything not clear, or anything you have any questions, whether you've been doing it for years or whether this is your first time? Is everything clear about how to practice mindfulness and meditation? Yes. Well, there's nothing behind the bowing. The bowing is a bow. It's just a custom, you know. I mean, in Asia, where Buddhism comes from, when people greet each other, they just bow. They put their hands together and they bow. It's a very simple thing. But you notice people bow here. I mean, I've been to many concerts where when the applause is going, whoever is performing will bow. So it's not something that is totally unknown here in the West. You know, it's just a sign of respect, you know. That's all. So, it's a thing we do with our body. The most important thing is we do with our mind. I mean, if we're doing it like that, but we, you know, are thinking about something else, the physical bowing doesn't have much meaning. So, you know, when we bow toward anything, toward each other, toward something, some object that has meaning to us, we bow acknowledging that we have a deep respect for it. And again, in our society, our culture, showing respect, having respect, is not something that is cultivated often, is it? Oftentimes, we are grown up with a sense that we're supposed to disrespect. That's healthy. But it's important that we understand in this life that there are some things to be respected. And by acknowledging through a bow that we understand that in this world there are some things that are important, some things that really have meaning and value, and respect is a way of our, it's good for us. It's good for us to respect each other. It's good for us to respect all human beings. It's good for us to respect the earth. When you respect something, then you are careful in your efforts around it. If we don't have respect and we just kind of, as many of us had, we just kind of wander about this world heedless. But the interesting thing is, if there's one thing we do demand respect for, is what? We want people to respect us, you see? So that's something we are acutely aware of, because when we perceive someone has disrespected us, we get hurt, or we get angry. So it's interesting. I mean, you know, we walk around the world with a sense that we should be respected. We're often, again, easily hurt or angered, irritated when people disrespect us, but then we often don't show the world and the people in it and the animals and the plants, water in it, with the respect that everything has value, everything has meaning. And to be respectful of it is to acknowledge that. It's good to bow. It's good practice. Thank you. Are there any other questions about... Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, again, there's a formal kind of walking meditation that one does in the meditation hall, which is very kind of precise and very inward. And again, all you could do is really follow the person in front of you, right? So you really don't have to look around, do you? So the practice is more precise in that sense. When we're in the hall, when we're walking with a sense of real awareness in the body, and a real sense of groundedness in the movement of this just walking. Obviously, when we're outside, there's more to see, right? And usually when we're outside, we're either looking around in every direction, attracted by this, attracted by that, repelled by that, we're endlessly looking around. And are looking around, and the things that are happening are endlessly generating thoughts, opinions, ideas, naming. Learning how to walk in the world, maintaining one's awareness, maintaining one's capacity to be present with whatever's arising, but not to be endlessly entering the world in the form of grasping, pushing away, thinking about, generating endless opinions and ideas, takes practice, right? So that's what we're practicing out there, sort of a more natural way of being in the world, but in the way that we don't lose our ground, we don't lose our center. We're always losing our center and just going out into the world. And then we wonder why we feel so tumbled about, why our minds are not at ease. Our minds are not at ease because we're endlessly generating all kinds of thoughts and opinions and ideas about the things that we see and hear and smell and taste and touch people. So a lot of wasted energy. Okay, so that's what we're practicing. As well as, since most of us, since we live in a city, we live in Tampa, it's nice to do walking meditation in the garden, in a park, by the sea. It's nourishing to kind of have sensual experiences that are very enriching. Right? Because we may not believe it, but we are natural beings. Right? And we do go through the same process of birth that all mammals go through. We may find that a little upsetting to know that, isn't it? That we are just like all the others. But we are. And so it's good to experience our connection with the earth like that, especially these days. Good. Any other questions? So, for those of you who are in the community or around the community, you know that we've been involved and we are involved in kind of studying and practicing as a community teachings both that relate to loving kindness and compassion, but more focused way on this path of the Bodhisattva, which I'll explain in a few minutes. So I am going to just share a little bit from a text called the 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. It was written by a 14th century Tibetan teacher by the name of Tokme Zongpo. Could have been an interesting character. He was born 1295. He was orphaned at an early age. His mother died when he was three. His father died 2 years later. His grandma took him in. She died 4 years later. And then an uncle took him in. So at a young age, for those of you who might think, you know, life kind of screwed you, you're not alone. But watch what he did with it. So then at the age of 14, he entered the monastic life at 14. He mastered the curriculum. By the time he was 19, he was renowned in his little universe as a great scholar and practitioner. In the Tibetan monasteries, it's not as if the monastery supports you. Traditionally, you had to find your own patrons or find your own way. So since he came from poor circumstances, he didn't have family to support him. So it was suggested to him, since life was quite difficult, that he do what a lot of the monks do, which would go out into the neighboring villages, kind of do rituals, do tantric rituals, do other kinds of things like that to earn, because usually when he did these for the lay people, they would give him some money. He didn't want to do that. He wanted just to practice. And so supposedly, he wrote the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva in response to the suggestion that he stop studying and practicing and go earn some money. He didn't want to do that. Obviously, he survived. And he was an interesting guy that even though as his, became highly respected in his little community there, he was an abbot for several years, but when they wanted to kind of re-up him, he declined, and he basically spent the next 20 years living in a cave above the monastery, devoted himself to practice. I first came across this text not that many years ago. I attended a retreat with a modern-day Tibetan Lama by the name of Garchen Rinpoche, a very interesting guy. He spent, don't quote me on this, but like 20, 25 years in a Chinese prison in Tibet under extremely harsh condition, torture, deprived, the whole deal. Communists were very harsh on the Buddhist teachers, especially. So he was, 20, 25 years in prison, tortured, harshness, deprivation, forced labor, the whole deal. Wasn't able to talk. I mean, very, very difficult situation. This guy was a light bulb. Big smile on his face. Just wonderful. no anger, no hatred, just generated great radiance. And I remember him saying that his time in prison was very good for him. He said, because if he had been, if he had spent that 20, 25 years in the monastery, he had lots of responsibilities. So he couldn't really practice all the time. You know, in the prison, he could practice all the time. As well as, he said, he happened to be in a prison with some great meditation masters. So he really was able to not only devote himself to practice single-mindedly, but he had great teachers. So he was grateful for the experience, quite wonderful. So again, and one of the things, and the reason I'm mentioning it up, because one of the things he did, he has these, he had made these little copies of these 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, and he would hand them out to everybody. So that's where I first encountered this, maybe 10 years ago or something. So obviously can't go into all of them today, but let's see what we can do. So he begins by paying homage. He says, "You who see that experience has no coming or going, yet pour your energy solely into helping beings. My excellent teachers and Lord of all seeing, I ever humbly honor with my body, speech, and mind." So before he begins to share whatever he wants to share, he says, "You," and he's talking about his excellent teachers, the Buddhas and the great enlightened beings. He says, "You who at the same time that you see that all experience is without beginning or end, who see clearly that there's no birth and no death, all of you who have the awakened vision, yet you pour your energy solely into helping beings." So here, this is really in two lines what a realized person in this bodhisattva path, this enlightened path, is up to. Even though, he's saying, although your mind dwells in this unconditioned state, yet you don't just, you know, enjoy yourself. Right? Stay home and just rest in your meditative equanimity. He says, yet you pour your energy solely into helping beings. My excellent teachers, I ever humbly honor with my body, speech, and mind. Okay? Respect. He honors them. He bows to them. And then he says, in intention, he says, fully awakening Buddha. Here's Buddha with a small b. So this means our awakened nature. The source of joy and well-being comes as you master the noble way. The noble way is the way of practice. You know, it is the way toward Buddhahood. It is the Eightfold Path. It is the Six Paramitas. It is the whole cacophony of practices that we undertake so we can awaken to our inherent Buddha mind, which is the source of joy and well-being. See, we think, many of us, is that the source of joy and well-being is in the world of activity, in things. But since joy and well-being are states of mind, and since joy and well-being arise within the mind, then the source of joy and well-being has to be within our mind. Right? So rather than always going out here, why don't we go to the source? So therefore, the joy and well-being can always be constant. So he says, full awakening, the source of joy and well-being, comes as you master this noble way. And because mastery depends on knowing how to practice, I now explain the practices of all bodhisattvas. So this is key. Because mastery depends on knowing how to practice. And I think last week or 2 weeks ago in our larger Sangha on Sunday, I gave a talk on the Bodhisattva path, and I use the example, or at some other point I can't remember. I said it's like one has the great desire to free all beings from disease, from illness, right? Wonderful intention. But you can't just go out and what? Start offering your services. Because you have no competency, do you? No. So that's your intention, but to become, but to master the skills and competencies necessary that you can really treat and heal people's diseases, you have to master the basic competencies, knowledge base, etc., of the field of medicine, of healing. Is that clear? We understand that. And so he's saying the same thing, because this mastery, mastery of your mind and really knowing the inherent joy and well-being of the mind, though even though you want to share that with beings, until you've mastered it for yourself, you really don't have that capacity yet. You may have the intention, but you don't have the capacity. So now he's going to explain to us, okay, how to develop that capacity. And so he begins. He says, right now you have a good boat, fully equipped and available, hard to find, to free yourself and others from the sea of samsara, day and night, constantly study, reflect, and meditate. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. And again, for those of you not familiar with these terms, bodhisattva just sort of means, it's a Sanskrit word, it implies an enlightened being, an awakened being, an awakened mind. But it also implies those who want to develop and cultivate the awakened mind. So he says, right now you have a good boat. He's talking about our bodies. This is our boat, right? We have a mind, but our mind, unless it's a kind of a ghostly existence, our mind is tethered to our body. And it is our body that lives in this world. It is all our senses that lives in this world. And it's through the body, the speech, etc., and the actions of our body that we enter the world and live. So he says, and this is, he's referring to a very specific kind of teaching. He said, right now you have a good body, good boat, fully equipped, which means you have, you have a mind that's not totally... you know what I mean? We don't have dementia yet. we don't have major psychiatric impairments. We do have a certain degree of ability to think clearly and logically and be self-aware. So, I mean, we have a good mind. And hopefully we're all here because we have some degree of good health, or else we would be in a hospital or homesick. So just the fact that we're all here means that we have some degree of health, we have some degree of mind capability, and we have some degree of leisure. You know, I mean, we're not working 24/7. So we have the leisure that we can take a day and to come and look at these matters of mind and mindfulness, and their Dharma halls, meditation halls are available, and their teachings available, and their teachers available. And you get it? Things have come together for us very nicely. Hard to find. Not everybody has this in this world. Actually, most people don't. So he says, right now we got the boat. It's a good boat, and we're in a good place. So we can free ourselves and others from the sea of delusion, from the sea of suffering, from the sea of confusion. Most people want to be happy, but they don't know how to be happy. Right? Most people want to be happy, but they do things that only create unhappiness for themselves and others. So it's these people we want to help, but until we get clear ourselves, our ability is limited. So he says, study, reflect, meditate. Right? And again, it doesn't mean you have to go off to a monastery, because... we all have time. And we all say we're very busy, but the truth is a lot of our busyness is with things that are not that meaningful. Right? If we were honest with ourselves, we'd have to say that. And that even though we may have a busy life, we all have time. We may have to prioritize our time a bit. So we all have time. Some time to formally study the teachings, sometimes, you know, to meditate, but reflect. We can always be reflective. We're at work, we can be reflective, right? We're going about the world, we can be reflective. The things we see, the things we hear, we can reflect on things in a meaningful way to deepen our understanding of ourselves and life. So the capacity to study, reflect, and meditate, even though because of the nature of our life, each of us may have different quotient of time to study, reflect, and meditate, we all have time. And please, we need to stop deluding ourselves that we're too busy to practice. But I know nobody in here thinks that. I could make it go faster, but I'm sort of enjoying it coming out slowly. We're always in a hurry, aren't we? I have a 36-year-old son. I drive him crazy. He says, Dad, you know, because he sees how I'm on the computer, he says, you know, you could do it so much faster. And when I say to him, I'm not interested in doing it faster. We think somehow doing things faster and faster somehow is beneficial. Really the how we do things that's most important. Attraction to those close to you catches you in its currents. Aversion to those who oppose you burns inside. Indifference that ignores what needs to be done is a black hole. Leave your homeland. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So again, many of us are not going to be leaving Tampa tomorrow based on hearing this, or Florida, but leave your homeland. I would say, I mean, it's more of a way of kind of abandoning, a way of being in our homeland. Attraction to those close to you catches you in its current. So we're attracted to certain people, and we get involved in them, and we get involved in their lives and their dramas, and it's endlessly catches us in the currents of their soap operas. Everybody know what I'm talking about? Good. Aversion to those who you oppose burns inside. Right? So you know, people you don't like, people close by, people in far away, you know, it could be thousands of miles away. We just read about it, we hear about it, it just burns inside us. Right? So usually our minds are just going back and forth between attraction and aversion, right? And then we're indifferent. We have indifference to really what matters and would really be most beneficial to us and the world. And he says, that's a black hole. A black hole is what? Anybody ever fall into a black hole? What's a black hole? What? What? Yeah, it's kind of, you know, you just fall into a black hole. It's just kind of, it has no definition, and you could just stay there. Everybody know the black hole? Not a good place to hang out. So again, he's not saying leave those you're close to. He's not saying leave those who you don't agree with, but leave that endless attraction and aversion, that back and forth that's always disturbing the mind. And again, it can go back and forth. You know, there could be somebody that we have aversion to, and then they do it the way we want or say it the way we want, then what? Now we have attachment to them. They're wonderful. Can't get enough of them. And then they do something that, you know, they say something, you know, right? Number, leave your homeland, which means leave this way of relating to things. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Number three, don't engage disturbances and emotional reactions gradually fade away. Don't engage distractions, and spiritual practice naturally grows. Keep awareness clear and vivid, and confidence in the way arises. Rely on silence. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So you can see, even though these are short verses, there's a lot of wonderful meaning. Now, if we think about our life and the lives of people around us, is it always smooth sailing? No, Kevin? You laugh. No, little disturbances every day within you, within your life, within your work. Things don't just go exactly the way you want. No? People don't act just the way you want. Really? So, is that true? Anybody else have the same experience as Kevin? Yeah, there you go. So he says, if we don't engage in these disturbances, emotional reactivity gradually fades away. If we wonder why we live in a world, internal world, where there's so much emotional reactivity within us, or we look around the world at our friends and family, the world, politicians, everything, you know, why are they so emotionally reactive? Because everything's a big deal, isn't it? Everything's a big deal, isn't it? When everything's a big deal, emotional reactivity is the name of the game. There are some things in life that are a big deal. We need to know what those are. And we need to know those things in life that aren't a big deal. They're just life. Okay? That's very important. That's wisdom. Don't engage distractions, and spiritual practice naturally grows. Okay, anybody remember 2 hours of meditation this morning? Right? No. So again, our practice, let's say, and again, everybody, I don't know what was going on, everybody's practice, but let's say your practice was a mindfulness of the body breath, right? So when we're practicing that way, and we want to stay focused and concentrated on something, anything that's not that, we call a what? A distraction. I mean, it's kind of simple, okay? I mean, if your practice was to just follow all your thoughts, then your breath would be called a distraction. So there's nothing inherently, distractible about anything other than we decide consciously there are some good places to put our mind, right? To develop whatever we're developing. And anything that takes us away from that is what? A distraction. Is that clear? So there's no, I mean, distractions don't have signs that say distraction. Distraction is something based on what we're doing. Don't engage distractions, and spiritual practice naturally grows. Again, like in our meditation, if we want to be cultivating mindfulness and concentration, right? That's our quote-unquote spiritual practice at the time. If we keep getting lost in the thoughts that are arising in our mind and we let them take us away, right? Our meditative capacity will not develop. It's very simple. On the other hand, if he says we don't engage with these distractions, then spiritual practice will naturally grow. You see how simple this is. For those of you who think spiritual practice is somehow very difficult or complex, complicated, this is easy. So simple. You know? We know what the wholesome is. We want to focus on that. Anything that takes us away from that is a distraction. Right? Keep it simple. If you want to cultivate the loving kindness in your life, then if you're cultivating irritation, anger, judgment, etc., what are you cultivating? A distraction from your purpose. if you want to, if you want to cultivate equanimity, so your mind has ease in it, and you're able to kind of move with things. You know, anything that takes you away from that is a distraction, distractive mind state. Is that clear? Yeah. So it's kind of, and you know, right? If you say, "I'm going to clean the house today," anybody ever make that intention? You ever get distracted? Kelly, yes, I can see you laughing, right? So if our intention is to clean the house, anything that takes us away from that is called a what? Distraction. At other times, what you're doing could be meaningful, all right? So distraction is really clear. There's clarity. So if we have clarity, about our, you know, what we want to do, quote unquote, in our spiritual practice, whatever it is, to heal and transform ourselves, if that's where we want to put our energy, then anything that takes us away from that is a distraction. Is that it? Yeah, good. Keep awareness clear and vivid, and confidence in the way arises. So awareness is like right now. Right now, everyone here in this room is aware. Is that clear? All of us are aware in this moment. You with your eyes, you see. You're aware of me visually, right? You're aware of the whole room. Sounds, you're aware. You're aware of what's going on in your body. Some people may have pleasant feelings in their body. Some people may have unpleasant feelings in their body. It's because you're aware of all these things. How do you know that a thought has arisen? Because you're aware of it. Right? How do you know how you feel? Because you're aware. So awareness is key. It is essentially who we are. We are awareness. And awareness is manifesting in all these endless ways through our senses, through our mind, through our thought. It's all about awareness, okay? So he says, keep awareness clear and vivid, very fundamental instructions, right? You know, keep the windows clean, right? Anybody can think of their house and they haven't cleaned their windows in several years? What? What happens when you don't clean your windows for years and years? When you look out the window, do you see everything very clearly? No. Things get distorted because the window's dirty. If the window's very dirty, you might not even be able to see outside. Right? Very dirty windows. Very dirty. Glasses, right? So we want to keep our awareness very clear so we can see what's really going on around us, within us, thoughts, feelings, perceptions. So keep awareness clear and vivid. Vivid means very alive, very present. And confidence in the way arises. The way means, you know, the way of awakening, the way of practice, the way of our spiritual life, the way we're living. So we will gain confidence in the way of awakening, the way of healing, transformation, whatever you want to call your way, when there's greater clarity of mind. If there's no clarity of mind, very hard to even see what we're doing, where we are, where we're going, where we've been. With clarity, we see that. So let me, there's 37 verses, and I'm certainly kind of willing to share some others with you. But any questions so far about this good boat, about study, reflect, meditate, about attraction to those close to you, aversion to those oppose you, indifference to what needs to be done, about engaging in disturbances and emotional reactions, about engaging in distractions, about keeping awareness clear and vivid. Anybody think about it? Everybody know how to do all that? I'm serious. Everybody know how to do that? If you don't, please ask a question. Because he's telling us what the practices of 37 practices of someone who aspires to become an enlightened being. Yes. This is being recorded? Okay, so I'm just going to have to repeat it. Yeah, so the question is, the gentleman in the second row says, it seems to me that, isn't it really about intention? You know, that you know, my intention is to be compassionate, or my intention is to do this or that. And if I don't really have that intention, then it's very easy to get lost in all other kinds of disturbances, distractions, etc. Yes, I mean that really is. And those of you who've been around and heard me in the past, you know I do spend a lot of time saying that really intention, aspiration is the key piece, even more than the practices themselves. We have to know where we're going, like you're saying. Like he's talking about distractions and all this, but we need criteria. Like I said, distraction or something that's a distraction is something that we're deciding, right? Right. If our purpose in life was to always watch the latest Netflix series, right? If that was our purpose in life, you see, then anything that took us away from that, we would call a distraction. Right? So if tonight there's a whole new series on and I really want to watch it, and if Kevin says, hey, Fred, would you like to go to meditation tonight? I would say, Kevin, stop distracting me. Right? You see what I'm saying? Right? Because my focus is binge watching tonight. I'm just using that example, you see? And so, yeah, we don't realize that, see, for many of us, we are not clear. There's not a lot of clarity about our aspiration and intention. So therefore, we don't have criteria. It's like sitting down and meditating. If we don't, there are many people who, when you ask them what they do in their meditation, they sort of say, well, I just kind of sit. Well, again, there is probably benefit to just stopping and sitting. But to stop and sit, and you're just kind of, ruminating about the things you ruminate about and doing the planning you're usually planning. And, what's the benefit in that? There probably is some just benefit from just stopping and sitting. I'm not saying that. But, it's really about, I'm sitting down and I'm taking this time to practice meditation because I want to do something. I want to do something meaningful with this time. Well, what is that? Are we clear what that is? So we can decide what's a distraction from. If I don't have that criteria, then we might say, as many people say, well, planning my day is important, isn't it? Isn't that a good use for meditation? I'm planning my day. Or I was kind of going over what happened earlier in the day and kind of, just reflecting on it, Isn't that a good use of meditation? Well, it depends, again, what you're doing, the bigger picture. You see? So you're absolutely right that intention aspiration is not only meaningful for the big choices in our life, you know, how I spend my time, my energy, how I show up in life, right? But also just in the, you know, just moment-to-moment choices, right? You know, do I go to meditation tonight or do I stay home and what? I mean, there will be, you know, there are endless things to stay home for, aren't there? Right? It's like people, you know, so many people have so much difficulty establishing a daily meditation practice, right?
Right.
But why is that? Why is that? It's not a priority. So there's always, you know, people will say, well, you know, I get up in the morning and I really think I should meditate. But first I go do this, and then I go take care of that, and then I check my email, and then I go do this, and then, you know. And before I know it, I don't have any time. Have you ever heard that? Anybody know that experience? But if you get up in the morning and every day, you know, you same way you brush your teeth and you wash your face or you get your tea or coffee, you know, you the next thing you do is you do what? You do your meditation. I mean, it's just kind of simple. You know, the only reason we get distracted and we never get to it is because why? Because we don't have clear intention and aspiration, you know. The daily meditation, if we go day by day, there's always, you know, a decent reason not to do it today, right? Because why? Anybody ever know that they should meditate, but then they don't? Because why? Because our little mind starts telling us what? Anybody want to share what their little mind tells them? Come on. What? Yeah, I get this done. Get that. Take it. All right, there you go. And before you know it, right. Yeah. Right. So again, that's where aspiration, intention in life is, you know, where am I going in this life? Right? Where do I want to go in this life? How do I want to be in this life? Right? And if that's, you know, and then how do I get there? Like he says, you know, we want to be awake, we want to be a Buddha, we want to help all beings in a very deep way, help them really get at the source of their suffering so they really can be free and be happy and joyful in life. Yeah, that's what I want to do. Well, we have to, as he says, we have to master the practices. So we got to be clear that that's what we're up to. Big picture. And every day we got to realize, oh, my daily meditation, how does that fit into that? You see, if we don't have that thing, you know, it's like somebody with a bad habit, right, that they want to break. Like they want to stop eating this kind of food. Anybody ever try to do that? Right? Or they want to stop drinking, or they want to stop doing this, you know. You see, the problem is you can always convince yourself on a case-by-case basis, that this doesn't matter, does it? You know? Right? Can't we? See how good we are? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I want to eat healthier. Yeah, so what if I just right now, you know, eat a bag of Cheetos? Right? In terms of the unfolding of the cosmos, You know, does my eating a bag of Cheetos, you know, having a drink, you know, doing this, doing that. I mean, no, right? Can you see that endless rationalizing mind will keep us forever from not doing what he says? Not, it's a black hole, and we all spend a lot of time in that black hole, indifferent to what needs to be done, because we don't have clear aspiration. We don't have a path that we're clear about. And we don't see how what I'm doing today, how it fits into that. You see, because if we don't have that, We can endlessly distract ourselves with seeming important things to do. Right, Rita? So when Rita thinks about all the important things she's got to do before she meditates, don't they seem very important to her? Yes, you see. Right? It's only when you step back and you realize, well, this is the seventh week that I've made the intention to start meditating and I still haven't. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, now why is that? Because every day we have that rationalization. There's always something more important. You know, if there is something more important, then set that as your intention. Right? I just want to be the busiest person all in the world. I just want to be doing things all day long. Okay? So then you're at least congruent with what you're doing. Right? But if you say, I really want to understand what's going on here. I really want to understand my mind better. I want to free myself from my emotional afflictions. I want to really develop clarity of mind and of vividness, as he says. You see, if that's what you really want, then all this other stuff becomes distractions. So we have to stop fooling ourselves. We have to stop fooling ourselves that we really have spiritual aspiration. Because the truth is what? We don't. Now, we could develop it. There is a technology to developing it. If that's what we really want. I mean, it sounds good. I mean, right? Does full awakening, how does that sound to you? Anybody have a problem with full awakening? Anybody have a problem with, you know, having a compassion, loving heart? You know, an egoless heart? Right? Being happy, being joyful. Anybody have a problem with that? No. Go on, yes. I mean, Cheryl, yeah, I mean, you know, that and other reasons. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's why I am a great advocate of practicing with one's resistance. Right? Resistances mean when we're resistant doing something. And to rather than either just indulging the resistance forever, right? Or yeah, is to really look at it. I mean, to me, the edge of practice is always where I'm resisting, where I'm saying no. You know, there's the wall of self. There's the wall of me. Right? And that's the place, you know, because you may not know, but you. If you're insightful, you go, yeah, this is the seventh week, and I do, yeah, and I do, you know, I mean, I read the books, I mean, you know, I just bought three more, you know, I mean, you know, my bookshelf is growing, you know what I mean? That shows you at some level, this is something that I know is good for me, and yet, I can't seem to, you know. And that's, rather than something just to indulge or something to live with, my sense is that's something to look at. You know, what is that? You know. And again, you know, I mean, maybe Rita's just fooling herself and she's just really a total worldly human being and she really only wants to do worldly things and couldn't care less about spiritual matters other than she thinks it looks good or something. You know what I mean? I mean, that could be, couldn't it? For all of us. Or it could be that you really do inside want to change, and yet there is this resistance, whether it's just habit energy, you just need to push through it, or whether it's more psychological, there's fears, or you know what I'm saying? It could be lots of things, but obviously, you know, they need to be faced, right? So it's not like 7 years and Rita's still going, I know daily meditation's good for me, I mean, you know?
Yeah, you've done that, so you know about that one, right? I mean, you know. There you go. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, so that's, important what you said. Some people consider meditation zoning out, right? You know, spacing out. You know, sort of like a drug experience, you know, it's kind of spacing out, zoning out, feels good. Let go, kick back, zone out. Sort of like sleep or other kinds of things. Maybe there are meditative systems that encourage that kind of zoning out or spacing out or, meditation as a kind of escape from. But that's not Buddhist meditation, especially not Zen, Dzogchen meditation, which is really developing another kind of mind. Mind that is very precise, very clear, very present, very wakeful, very energetic, very alive, okay? Which we might call our natural mind. It could be actually the way our mind really is, in the sense that, you know, when the windows are clean, you know, we can see everything clearly, right? Clarity is the nature of a window. It's clear. A clear window, its nature is clear. The only reason we cannot see clearly through it is because it is dirty. You understand what I'm saying? So, if we might say that clarity and vividness is the very nature of our mind, right, we need to cultivate that. If we're just cultivating thought, obsession, rumination, endless mental fabrication, emotionality, drama, if this is what we're cultivating all day, that's the dirty window. We'll never see the natural vividness and clarity of our mind, will we? Because we're not looking, you know, we're looking in the wrong direction. So he's making a very powerful point here. You know, what do we want? Do we want to experience the natural clarity and vividness of our mind? Right? And live from that place in life? Or do we want to continue to just live in the confusions, the cloudiness, the endless distractibility that we think is our mind, which is not. I mean, we could come in here. Actually, when we bought this place, Alex remembers, Sam remembers, we didn't have windows like this. What kind of windows did we have, Alex? Blue plastic windows. And therefore, everything in here had a nice tinge of blue to it. And if you wanted to look out, you could not look out. Right. Well, you saw it. It wasn't even solid blue. It was kind of wavy blue. What? Stained. It was faux stained glass. And not on the high side of faux stained glass. But yeah, I mean, you know, so, you know, that was the world. We couldn't see outside. We couldn't see clearly. Everything was blue. And if we had lived our whole life in this hall,
And if we always thought that was a window that blew, we would think that what? That everything having a blue tinge and not to be able to see out was normal. That's our condition. But luckily, when we were renovating here, we had some people who pointed out to us that those are blue plastic faux stained glass windows, and they can be replaced. When they're replaced with things that are clear, we can vividly see the world, can't we? On the other hand, if we never wash the windows, or if we do things that are always soiling the windows, which unfortunately we do, we will lose that capacity to see out clearly. And that is what we do. And not only as we go about the world, are we taking in, you might say, dirt, but we are also generating a lot of dirt ourselves. So it's a bad combination. And over time, the clarity and vividness of our minds are not apparent to us at all. Meditation, I'm just pushing this one a little further, you know, meditation, mindfulness, concentration, you know, this is the window cleaning. Okay? This is how we clean our window, the window of our mind. But please remember, the mind is already in its nature, in its essence. It's not as if we got to go find a new mind. We just got to take out the impurities of the ones, of what we've done to our mind. That's a wonderful thing about Buddhist teaching. It says, we are all already Buddhas. Our mind is already natural and vivid and alive and clear. Okay? That's its nature. Water. It's got to be worked through the system so it can get clear. Reverse osmosis, whatever they do. Right? So the water is clear already, it's pure. But it's been contaminated. We just got to get rid of the contaminants, then we can drink the water. We don't have to throw the water out, do we? We just got to put it through the process of purification. That's what spiritual practice is about, putting our body, speech, and mind through the process of purification, getting out all the impediments, all the contaminants. Okay. Did that answer your question? What? If it didn't, you can ask again. What? You sure? Okay. Any other questions about what we've talked about so far? Is clear. Good. With some friends, the three poisons keep growing. Study, reflection, and meditation weaken, while loving kindness and compassion fall away. Give up bad friends. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Right? Everybody know what we're talking about here. So we don't live in caves. We don't live in pure environments. We live in the world. We have friends. We have acquaintances. We go to work. We have colleagues, right? And not everybody's a fully enlightened bodhisattva on the path. And yet, within the realm of relationships, we do have choices, don't we? Sometimes. Not all the time. We have choices. You know, who do we hang out with? Do we spend time with? And are we spending time with people who nurture the positive qualities, our love and compassion, our understanding, our desire to lead a meaningful life and do meaningful activities? Or do we hang out with people a lot who either don't do that or do the opposite? Again, this doesn't mean you cut everybody out. Or it may mean that. I don't know. You know, each of us has to look at our life and our relationships and decide at this stage of our life. And that's another thing is, see, for many of us, you know, we didn't get into this when we were seven. Right? So many of us get into a spiritual path, a transformative path, already with lots of relationships. But we all know relationships change. And that there may be a time when certain relationships where we found very enjoyable or whatever, because that's where we're at. But 10, 15, 20 years later, we may find it's not that way at all. I mean, that's just the way it is, isn't it? And we all know that. We all change. And often as we change, our interests change. The kind of person we are changes. The kind of things we like to talk about changes. And so the people that we liked hanging out with when we were into other things, we don't enjoy hanging out with anymore. Right? I mean, does everybody know what we're talking about here? And that's just the way things go. Now, there are certain relationships we're stuck with, like family. Yeah. There's certain kind of, or maybe people we work with, if we, you know what I mean. So I mean, there is certainly practices in terms of, you know, how to use all aversive relationships as a means of awakening and transformation. But it's also saying very practically, you know what he's saying. With some friends, the three poisons keep growing. That's, you know, greed, anger, delusion, fear, pride. I mean, there are some relationships that a lot of people nurture toxicity. Have you noticed that? Everybody know who I'm talking about, right? I mean, they're just toxic people. They always talk about toxic things. They're always putting out toxic vibrations. Forgive me for using the word, right? They're just toxic. And we need to decide whether that is somebody who is healthy for me to always be in relationship with. Because we may not be strong enough. You know, they may nurture the toxicity within us. And if we are, in my morning meditation, I'm really like, you know, getting the lens clean, right? Or I'm cleaning the window. And then I spend the rest of the day hanging out with people who just keep throwing dirt on. And I'm, you may wonder why, you know, it keeps never changing, you see? And so we have to kind of, again, look clearly. I mean, I think what he's pointing is to look clearly at our relationships and our friendships and really see, you know, what are they nurturing now in me? What are these relationships about now? And that's, we all go through change, including these other people. Then verse 6. With some teachers, your shortcomings fade away and abilities grow like the waxing moon. Hold such teachers dear to you, dearer than your own body. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So, this is the other side. There are relationships in life that are what? That are very nurturing, that are very supportive of all the qualities we want to develop. Right? And so, what's he saying? Hang out with these people. Hold them dear for you, to you. Others we may have to hold at arm's length. But there are some people, situations, experiences that we want to be closer to because they nurture us. And not only nurture in like a supportive way, this is not what he's talking about. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people who who give us support for things that really don't need support. You see, there's a lot of things that go on in friendship, in a relationship, that are nurturing things that really we shouldn't be nurturing anymore because they're not good for us. Is that clear? You know, I mean, there are a lot of people week after week, year after year, they're always stuck in their what? What? Stuck in their what? Their own stuff, right? And it doesn't matter how many times you've been there for them, how many times you've kind of tried to show them another way, they're what? Over again. Which is, again, I respect that. I mean, everyone has a right to that. But at some point, we got to realize, what am I supporting here? Am I just supporting the continuation of someone's suffering? And oftentimes, that's all we're doing. We think we're being kind and supportive, but we're not. We're really enabling somebody to continue in their patterns of suffering. And we call that friendship. I don't know if that's friendship. I'm not saying it's not, but I think it's something worth looking at. What does it mean to really help somebody? At certain points, being a good listener is helpful to somebody, isn't it? Do you see? But at a certain point, it isn't. It's just enabling this pattern of suffering. You know, it's like some people, every time you talk to them, what? You know, what's their anger of the day? What's their hurt of the day? What's their disappointment of the day? What's their fear of the day? Right? Everybody know what I'm talking about. At some point, it's like listening to this is not helping them. It's only actually hurting them because I'm reinforcing that their endless angers and hurts and fears, etc., you know, are worth talking about. You know, I mean, wouldn't you rather talk about with your friends things that are helpful to them? That support, that nurture positive things in them? You know, a lot of people, when they start going down that same road, you got to say to them, excuse me, you know, can you tell me one positive thing that happened today? You know, change the conversation. You know, change the conversation. You know, can you tell me, can you name me a couple of good qualities in this person? I mean, I was talking to somebody last week who's married. You know, who's married and says he loves this woman. And he's going on and on about her this and her that. You know? And I say to him, I mean, this was unbelievable. I said to him, I mean, doesn't she have any positive qualities? I mean, I kind of just said it, doesn't she? You know? And he stopped. And he couldn't think of any. You know, it's like he had to, you know. Now, again, I know the woman. She has many positive qualities, but it shows you where people get caught in their mind. You see? And that was helpful to him because I held him to it. And he realized how distorted he had become in his relationship with her, that he was only noticing the negative. Is that clear? It's like, I couldn't take it anymore. And that was after about 5 minutes. Right? I'll listen for a few minutes until I get what's going on. And if it's, and I see it's distorted in a nice way, I'll point it out. You know, does she have any positive qualities at all? Anything good happen to you today? Hmm? You know, tell me something. At least, you know, for every negative thing, I want to hear one thing positive. That's the deal. They may not want to meet you for lunch anymore. But you know, we're not helping them anyhow. Yes. Oh. And I can remember years ago, I mean, I take the phone, I hold it out here. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, it's like,
every now and then I go, oh, okay. What? Yeah, so again, I would say, it's also a matter of us too, you see. Again, if we're a fully enlightened Buddha, if we're the Dalai Lama, we could listen to anybody, right? And we'd have the skill and ability to really transform all these experiences. But many of us don't have that capacity yet. And so if we realize, yeah, this person's negativity is more than I can handle it because it makes me negative. It affects me. Then you know there's something imbalanced here. Yeah, I mean, I've often said that about certain people. I said, you know, I am just not that developed to hang out with that person. You know, I'll be honest with you. You know, they need somebody a lot more developed than me. I don't, you know. You see what I'm saying? But that's honest, isn't it? Now, it doesn't mean that's, you know, that we don't want to see where our edge is and we don't want to, you know, open, but, you know, certain people are just toxic. It's sad. I mean, I'm not going, like, judgmental. You know, it's just sad. Right? I mean, certain people are just so caught up in negative emotions and negative, you know, their issues endlessly, over and over and over again, and they don't see any way out. That's, we call that confusion. You know, like Shanti Davis says, people want to be happy, and yet they endlessly do things that only increase their unhappiness. It's sad, right? But that's the truth, you know. And if we don't know how to help them, then we should certainly not hurt them by reinforcing endlessly that which causes them suffering and causes others suffering. And we shouldn't be, you know, many of us, we're too polite or we're too scared, you know, what's going to happen, to maybe point out to somebody, whew, you're really toxic today, aren't you? You know? You know, like, you know, you've been telling me this for 5 minutes. Can we change the subject? I mean, I get it. You know, years ago, I love taking people to an extreme. You know, like the guy be going off about his wife this, his wife that. You know, I'd say to him, well, leave her. Why don't you just leave her? She sounds like a horrible person. You know, just take it to, leave her. You know, he or she would look at me like, what? Well, if they're that horrible person, why do you want to live with them? Leave her. You know, leave the kids, leave this, screw it. You know, go to Mexico, start all over again. I mean, I'd say that to people. And you know what they say to me? Oh, I could never do that. And then I go, oh, so you're committed to them. Well, that's nice. So let's talk about what you can do to create a better relationship than, you know. Is everybody clear? We should talk that way to ourselves when we're just going on and on with negativity. Kelly? You mean sucking in that energy from somebody else?
Yeah, I can definitely
Yeah, so again, it's, you know, it's not black and white. It's not black and white. We're talking about discernment. I mean, at a certain point, listening to somebody, being a supportive friend, is someone who's suffering, right, is meaningful, is helpful, right? Of course. But at a certain point, we realize, because it's happening over and over, that it's not helpful. And obviously, we have to discern, as you use the word, you know, at what point that which appears compassionate is really harmful.
I guess it's us versus them.
Us. again, I think, as I tried to just say, I also think we have to do the same thing to ourselves. I mean, all of us have toxic parts of ourselves that we often give free rein to. So, I mean, to me, it's not dualistic. I mean, it's like, it's everywhere. I mean, we bodhisattvas want to what? They want to end people's suffering. They want to be helpful to people. That's whether it's ourselves, whether it's our family, our friends, the world. That's always the operating principle, ending suffering. So there's that wisdom component. So it's not sentimental. It's not, oh, you know, I'm you know, I want to be, you know, a supportive person. Well, again, there's always a supporting. You know, what are you supporting in that somebody? As you know, I mean, you know, if you go get your alcoholic friend, you know, if you pick him up a fifth on the way home, or you're going to visit them, is that helpful? Well, again, yeah, well, you can endlessly rationalize it. Are you really helping them? Yeah. I mean, if they're going through detox, I would, you know, I'd call 911 and tell them, you know, somebody's really screwed up here physically. Can you go get them? Or get them, they still call it Marshman Act. What do they used to call it? Call the police. Yeah, Baker Act them. Thank you. See, I've been out of the field a while. But, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think we have to really, you know, we have to be aware. You know, just like ourselves, you know, coming back to Rita, you know, we have to have this kind of self-awareness that we're willing to call ourselves on our own stuff, our own BS. You know, many times we don't do that. We just indulge it. And then we indulge it in others. And again, this is not like, you know, you go around the world just telling everybody what you think of them and, you know, tell everybody to get over it. You know, it's not that extreme, right? Of course, it may, you know, they may not call you anymore if that's your advice you're giving. It's not that. You know, it's, again, there's wisdom in our compassion. There's wisdom, you know, we want to help. And we want to use our helpful energy, you know, in a way that helps. You know, a lot of times, I mean, there are a lot of people who don't want to be helped. It's sad. They suffer, but they really don't want to be helped. They're not there yet. They just want to tell you about how they suffer. We all have choices in this life, right? How we want to be and how we want to help. You've heard me say, you know, if you're in the hospital, you know, who's giving you your care primarily? What? No, who's primarily giving you care? Your nurses, right? Yeah, the truth is the nurses are the ones who are there supporting you emotionally, you know, emptying the bedpans, coming to you in the middle of the night, okay? So there is certainly something to say for when somebody's acutely ill for just being supportive. But the role of the physician is to what? The physician has a special role. And we would always hope that they're playing it. We want the physician to be that person. What does she or he do? What? They really know what's the cause of our suffering, right? And they know how to treat the cause of our suffering. And they know, I mean, that's what we want from our physicians, right? We don't expect that from our nurses. We expect from our nurses what? What? Care, support, that they understand the condition we're in and they know how to help us, right? Nurses certainly have a wonderful role to play, but we count on the doctor to know, why am I suffering? Why do I have this disease? And to prescribe in a way, some kind of procedure that helps us get well. You know, each of us has to decide which one of these do I want to be? Right? Which one of those do I want to be? And there are, you know, and that's a choice. It's not like one's better than the other, you know what I'm saying? But they have different roles.
Bodhisattvas have very clear roles in this world. They want to alleviate the suffering of beings by helping them see essentially how they're causing their own suffering and how they're causing suffering to others. There's a wisdom component. They're not just only caring and compassionate to the immediacy of someone's suffering. They want to go deeply to really help someone. Yes.
There you go. Can you just hold on 1 second, Joseph? Verse, it's funny, I'm quoting verse in scripture to a pastor, so forgive me for that. So, but these are actually verses. Even if you have done nothing wrong at all, and someone still tries to take your head off, spurred by compassion, take all his or her venom into you. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if someone broadcasts to the whole universe slanderous and ugly rumors about you, again and again, with an open and caring heart, praise his or her abilities. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. High practice. Even if someone humiliates you and denounces you in front of a crowd of people, think of this person as your teacher and humbly honor him or her. This is the practice. Even if a person you have cared for is your own child, anybody who's ever had children and they become teenagers may know what we're talking about here. Even if a person you have cared for as your own child treats you as their worst enemy, lavish him or her with loving attention like a mother caring for a ill child. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. And it goes on. So, I mean, there are 37 practices here, but there obviously is a whole body of teaching and practice for what you say, when it's personal, right? When the toxicity and the adversity is coming directly at you, you know, what do you do? And there's got to be a way to transform it. So, and does this happen? I mean, you're a pastor in the Christian faith. Look what happened to Jesus. I mean, was he basically a good man? Did people talk negatively about him? Slander him, harm him, quite. And yet, what? So there's the model. I mean, it's a high model, I understand. It's a what?
Practice,
yeah. Yeah. And way of, in the Bodhisattva past, it's called the exchange of self and other, or tonglen. It means, and it's an actual practice, where you learn to take in the toxicity that's maybe directed at you, or your own toxicity, the toxicity of the world, and not hold it, not let it become toxic inside you, but transform it and you know, put it out in a positive way. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, so that's certainly part of this path, of any spiritual path. Right? Yeah, very important. Yeah. I mean, there are 37 verses, and probably a good quarter of them deal with, you know, dealing with adversity in this way. Again, and you can see the examples are, you know, how do you deal with a world, you know,
Is everybody happy the way the world's going? No? You're kidding. Right? I mean, how do you deal with it? You know? People aren't treating us the way we want to be treated. People often may be unfairly treating us, right? How about this world? You know, so it's not like this is unknown. To learn how to deal with the adversity, the toxicity, the negativity, the delusion, you know, of the world. So it, you know, you've heard me say, for those you've been around, it said the bodhisattva is like the peacock. You've heard that? In India, there's, you know what a peacock is? We don't have them running around here. In India, they run around in certain areas. You know, they're beautiful. They have beautiful feathers, beautiful. And it is, and there's a certain seed. I think it's a castor seed or some seed that is very ubiquitous in India, but that is poisonous to many animals or birds. But it's said that the peacock not only can eat that seed, but when it eats it, its feathers become more beautiful. It's a very famous, and it means, you know, that to the bodhisattva they can take in that which is toxic to others, and it only makes them more beautiful, which means more compassionate, more understanding. But, you know, that's somebody who knows how to practice that way. Because if you can't practice that way, if you eat that little bit of poison, you may get poisoned, which is what you were saying. So we have to know. And I know it's almost 12:30, so. So good. I'm reading from a new translation of the Tokmei Zongpo's 37 Practice of Bodhisattva called Reflections on Silver River by a translator called Ken MacLeod. Silver River was the name of this place that he was in retreat for 20 years. So good. So it's now 12:30, which means it is time to eat lunch and have a nice, enjoyable meal. One can eat downstairs. One can go out in the garden and eat your lunch. If you look around and you see somebody is not eating, if they forgot their lunch, maybe you could share with them. Probably not appropriate to say, see, serves them right, you know. That's a little harsh, you see. We don't want to go to that extreme. Okay, Kelly, we're not going to go to that extreme. This is not like, yeah, this is a good learning lesson for them, right? You know, maybe they won't do this again. You know, if it's the 15th time, maybe you'll go, yeah, they need to. But if it's, we don't know that. So our first response should always be kindness. Yes, noble silence, if that was not stated already. So one of the wonderful things about a day of mindfulness, it's a day of silence. Silence is something that we are not used to, and often we don't get a lot of in our homes, in our society. So please remember that this is we're doing the day in silence. It is possible to be very connected to life and what we're doing and each other without even talking. By feeling our presence. So the day of silence, so this is an hour break, but in 50 minutes the bell will ring, and that'll give you a 10-minute warning to return at 1:30 for mindful movements. Again, mindful movements is not heavy-duty exercise or yoga. It's gentle, but it's movement. So it's a way, again, not only doing something good for our bodies, but also, you know, learning to be mindful in movement, guided meditation, silent meditation. It's a good day. Then we'll have closing circle, and we'll be done by 4:00.